This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in again this week. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. Harold James. Professor James is the Claude and Laura Kelly Professor in European Studies, the Professor of History and International Affairs, and Director, Program in Contemporary European Politics and Society at Princeton University. I caught up with Mr. James this past week. He was in Europe, and we're going to chat about the big Brexit vote coming up. Britain is holding a referendum. Citizens there will be voting this next week on whether or not to remain in the European Union. Now, you may think that doesn't mean a lot to you. You may think that may not affect you. However, Harold James and I will discuss it, and you will learn that that is not the case. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. And then joining me on the second part of today's podcast will be Mr. David Skarica. Mr. Skarica is the publisher of the newsletter Addicted to Profits. He was on the program about 6 months ago and accurately predicted the decline in the market in January. We're going to get an updated forecast from him. You won't want to miss that as well. If you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it's easy to become a subscriber. All you need to do to subscribe is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Harold James. He is the Claude and Laura Kelly Professor in European Studies. He's the Professor of History and International Affairs. He's Director, Program in Contemporary European Politics and Society at Princeton University. He has a book that will be released coming up the end of July titled The Euro and the Battle of Ideas. And Harold, welcome to the Everything Financial Radio program.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Dennis.
Harold, let's start by talking about the big vote coming up in the UK. Do you want to maybe just explain to the listeners first on a 101 level what this vote is all about?
The vote is about whether Britain should or should not remain as a member of the European Union. It's not really clear why this vote was needed. I think Prime Minister Cameron, David Cameron, caused the vote a long time ago, promised the vote, in order to deal with opposition within his own party, within the Conservative Party, a large part of which is really quite hostile to the EU. But there's obviously no constitutional reason why you should have this vote at this moment, and it's a vote that's setting off all kinds of waves of disturbance, political disturbance, financial and economic disturbance as well.
So, Harold, what do you see as the is coming up here from the time this interview airs in a matter of days? Do you have a prediction as to which way the vote might go?
Well, I'm very much hoping that the voters of the UK will vote to stay in the EU. But that's not the way the polls are looking at the moment. The polls are giving a quite substantial lead to the Brexit campaign, the campaign for getting Britain out of the Union. I think largely because many of the voters are worried about migration into the UK, into the United Kingdom, and think that getting out of Europe would make it easier to control that migration.
So, Harold, what... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, my expectation is still that the fear of a financial shock will stop people voting for the exit. But you can see already in the last few days, the pound's been under substantial pressure. If Britain were to vote to go out of the EU, that pressure would continue and it would really create major turbulence. So one of the things that's driving people to vote to stay in is the fear of the unknown. What happens if they step over that cliff, as it were?
So, Harold, what does this financial shock look like, in your opinion, assuming the vote is affirmative to leave the EU?
A lot depends on how other European countries will react to it, but I think people will start to speculate quite quickly about the possible collapse of the European Union as a whole, because the voters in Britain who are hostile to the EU are not alone. There are people who feel quite similar to them in the Netherlands, in Sweden, in Denmark, and all of those countries, I think, would be under substantial pressure to hold a similar referendum. That would create an enormous amount of uncertainty. And people would also then speculate about Germany, which is really at the core of the EU, is very committed to the process of European integration, wouldn't also give up if a significant number of countries that it thinks of as its allies in economic matters, economic and financial matters, if those allies would leave the European Union.
Harold, it seems to me that if Britain is the first country to vote to leave the EU, and they become the first domino in a series of many, that we could see currency markets that would be in just a state of chaos, unlike maybe chaos that's never been seen before. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right. There are little kind of versions of this strain. Some people are making comparisons with the volatility of the Swiss currency and the dramatic appreciation of the Swiss franc, but this is a shock that's going to be much, much greater than anything that Switzerland caused, and it's got the potential to be really disruptive, because people then traditionally what happens in these circumstances is that they look for a safe haven. The safe haven is usually the United States, but in the United States there's also a considerable amount of political uncertainty because of the nature of the presidential election.
So, Harold, assuming the Brexit vote goes the way the polls seem to be indicating, what ultimately effect does that have on trade?
It's really analogous, I think, to September 2008, and that's one word that has been often used to describe the effects of the Brexit vote, another Lehman shock. It potentially could really even be greater than Lehman. And you remember after Lehman, there was a six-month period in which world trade just contracted very, very quickly. But you can imagine what the impact of this would be also, for instance, on the presidential campaign in the United States, because if the dollar surges because of its safe haven status, it gets more expensive to buy American goods abroad, and the country will be flooded with imports, and the pressure to have a substantial amount of protection is going to be fueled by the campaign that Donald Trump is conducting. And it was fueled by what Bernie Sanders was saying, that campaign will be very, very, very much strengthened, and there will be a powerful anti-trade feeling in Congress.
Well, we are chatting with Harold James. Harold is the Claude and Laura Kelly Professor in European Studies, Professor of History and International Affairs, Director, Program in Contemporary European Politics and Society at Princeton University. He has a book that will be released in July of this year titled The Euro and the Battle of Ideas. And I'll continue my conversation with Harold James when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Well, I certainly hope you're enjoying my conversation with Harold James. So let me get right back to that conversation now. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Harold James. Harold is the Claude and Laura Kelly Professor in European Studies, Professor of History and International Affairs, and Director, Program in Contemporary European Politics and Society at Princeton University. He has a book that will be released in July of this year, The Euro and the Battle of Ideas. And I want to chat with Harold in this segment about a piece that he wrote titled The End of Globalization, Lessons from the Great Depression. And Harold, let's talk a bit about parallels between what we see today and what we saw at the beginning of the Great Depression.
So the Great Depression followed the First World War and followed a period in which there had been an enormous expansion of trade, of financial flows, also flows of people, the process that we call globalization today. And the Great War, the First World War, was a sort of setback to that process, but the politicians, the international statesmen, the big conferences from 1919 onwards, tried to put the system together again, and it broke apart definitively in the Great Depression. And so when I experienced the wave of the new globalization in the 1990s, I wondered about how vulnerable that might be to the same kind of shock as occurred in the Great Depression. And there was a kind of anticipation of this in the aftermath of the financial crisis and the failure of Lehman Brothers in September 2008, a dramatic contraction of world trade, but then something of a recovery. But the recovery has really been very anemic in most of the industrial countries, including the United States, where it's actually better than in most other countries. What was carrying the world economy for a time after 2008 was the strength and the vigor of emerging markets, but they're getting into difficulties now. You can see very, very terrible signs of the recession in Brazil, but the Chinese growth model is also beginning to come under attack.
So, Harold, where do you see, there's so many variables, but what do you see as far as the world economy is concerned moving ahead? Are we slumping back toward recession worldwide?
We're in for a period of greater volatility, and that's in the Great Depression. It's really going to be driven by political factors. There will be in at least some countries, I expect, very, very much more nationalist, nationally oriented politicians than the kind that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years. Mostly there's been a consensus to keep the international system going, to keep the world open. That was very, very powerfully expressed in a series of summit meetings in 2008 and 2009. But the tide is turning, and we may see people like Marine Le Pen from the National Front in France, or Beppe Grillo in Italy, a left-wing critic of globalization, getting majorities and forming governments. And that's really got the parallels with the Great Depression. And it's clearly a phenomenon that you can see in the United States as well, that there are many people who are upset about the way that globalization has worked and upset about the consequences in terms of income distribution that they see as following from globalization.
Harold, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going from memory, but it seems to me that at the beginning of the Great Depression, as a result of the protectionism, if you will, that prevailed, and huge tariffs and essentially trade wars, that world trade declined, I want to say 90% or so. It was really very, very, very harmful from my perspective and recollection. Would it be your view that this trend is going to be damaging moving ahead to the economy worldwide?
I think there may well be more trade protection, but that's actually not where I see the focus of today's anti-globalization movements as lying, in part because trade already is not growing very quickly. And we're seeing an interesting process where some manufacturing processes that were previously offshored, outsourced to Asia or elsewhere, are being returned, coming back to the big industrial centers, to the United States and elsewhere. but with the employment of very few people because they're employing robots. So the technology is driving something that's new there. But I think the major focus of anti-globalization concerns will be about the migration of people. This is a tremendous worry in the United States, but also in Europe. Europe has been wrestling with a refugee crisis since last summer. It shows no signs of stopping. A big movement of people now from sub-Saharan Africa crossing the Sahara and then going in little boats at great risk across the Mediterranean. It's that flow of people that is galvanizing politics and making voters choose politicians who will want to cut off all kinds of international links. And if you think about the United States, but if you think about other countries that have been at the forefront of technical development, they've benefited from having open labor markets. And in the United States, we've had a big inflow of skilled people who've helped Silicon Valley, other dynamic parts of the U.S. economy to develop. If you imagine closing that off, you're really going to restrict the potential. So my perception, both in Europe and in the United States, is that anti-globalization today is going to be driven by people and parties that respond to those people who want to restrict migration.
Well, we have been chatting today with Harold James. Harold has a book that is coming out at the end of July titled The Euro and the Battle of Ideas. And Harold, we've got about a minute left. Maybe you could tell the listeners about your book.
Sure. It's an examination of what drove the Euro crisis. And it looks in particular at the way in which different countries in Europe, in particular Germany and France, just conceptualize the way that economics works in a very different way. So it's very difficult for Germans and French to talk to each other. They don't have a common language. Very few Germans speak French. Very few French speak German. They have to speak in English. But most of all, most importantly, they don't really have the common conceptual framework. And that's one of the things that we've talked about, globalization disintegrating. Europe was a little micro-model of globalization, and Europe is under considerable strain because of this inability to see things in a common or collective way.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Harold, we certainly appreciate you joining us today, and we'd love to have you back.
It was a great pleasure being with you, Dennis.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday in the rich man's world.
Well, thank you to Harold James for joining me on this week's program. Joining me now, Mr. David Skorica. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. David Skorica. David is the writer of and publisher of the newsletter Addicted to Profits. You can learn more at addictedtoprofits.net. And his most recent book, published at the beginning of 2016, is titled Bear Market Rising. And David, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here again.
How about your book, Bear Market Rising, kind of an ominous title. Fill the listeners in.
Yeah, well, I actually became bearish on the market starting in about mid-2014, which obviously a large drop yet, but if you go look at it since 2014, the market has been in a big trading range. And I first wrote a book then called Collapse, and then this Bear Market Rising book is kind of like a follow-up to that. What has happened, if you go look at the market, you got a handful of stocks, you know, some of the FANG stocks or some of the dividend-related stocks because people, like, can't get any yield in bonds, et cetera, that have held up. But really, a lot of stocks and most stocks have started to underperform, which tends to happen early in bear markets. It happened in 2007. It happened in 2000. So my follow-up book was kind of, like, talking about it, again, reissuing, like, if you go look at indicators like half the GDP, or the Q ratio, or the amount of margin debt that's out there. You know, we're all seeing signs of a major a cyclical top in the equity markets. And I also, like, integrate, like, the bubble that's going on in China with their credit market. I also talk about, you know, how, you know, the Federal Reserve and the central banks have essentially helped create another equity bubble by you know, printing trillions and trillions of dollars over the past 7 to 8 years. So basically, that it's just a follow-up and it's a reconfirmation of what I still believe, why I think the market is a bubble, and this sort of thing.
David, let me go back to something you just said. You said the Federal Reserve, through this massive printing of money, quantitative easing, whatever you want to call it, you perfume a pig, it's still a pig. But if you look at that, you said that they're responsible for this equity market bubble. And I think it was former Dallas Federal Reserve Bank President Richard Fisher who, in an interview, came out and said, yeah, we dumped $1 trillion into the market. We wanted to create a wealth effect. So to what extent do you think this run from 2009 to the present in the market is attributed to actually solid business fundamentals, and what percentage is attributable to Fed policy?
Oh, I would think at least about half of it is Fed policy, meaning that if I just look at, say, the percentage gain of the market or the point gain, the S&P bottomed at 666 and rallied to over 2,100, so basically tripled and went up roughly 1,500 points. And I think that, you know, 700 to 800 of those 1,500 points are due to them juicing the market, you know, trying to create this wealth effect, like I said, and printing trillions of dollars to do so. Like, the idea is, you know, if a rich person owns $10 million worth of stock and all of a sudden it's $20 million, you know, he'll take that $10 million out and maybe buy a house, and then he's got to hire people at the house or work on the house, or buy a yacht, and then, you know, then that employs people. It's like this kind of trickle-down effect that didn't really work. If you look at wage gains of the average person, all this has been probably the worst recovery ever for that, even worse than the 2000s recovery. So I would say half, and part of the reason is I believe in kind of these secular market trends. And if you go look at the history of the U.S. stock market, and talk about this a bit, and I know I keep naming all my books here, but and my book I wrote about 5 or 6 years ago called The Great Supercycle, and I've talked about this a while even before that, but the equity markets in the United States tend to do these 15 to 20-year cycles where equities perform very well for a 15-year period, similar to 1982 to 2000, and then they do poorly for another 15 to 20-year period, similar to 1929 to 1949 or 66 to 1982. So I think that we're still in one of these 20-year periods. History would tell you that we probably should have peaked out on the S&P, you know, between 13 and 1600, roughly at the high of 2000 and 2007. But I think that big move higher from 2100 was almost all the Federal Reserve. Because remember, in 2013, the year that you had the big breakout and the market did move up like that, that was the year that they printed $1 trillion. And then in 2014, when you had another good year for the market, they wound down the QE, but they still printed, I think, roughly $500 billion that year. So I think definitely this has to do a lot with the Federal Reserve's policies and the whatnot, right? Like basically trying to use this wealth effect and all this sort of thing. So, you know, that's kind of what I believe. And I think that the technicals show that, because in a secular bear market, which I still think we are, meaning the long-term you shouldn't reach new highs like we did, and we didn't in the 70s, and we didn't in the 30s and 40s, and didn't. And I think the reason that we have this time is solely due to this kind of monetary experiment. And just on that note, I think that, you know, when we look back at the housing bubble, what does everyone say? We all say that Greenspan did not raise rates soon enough or fast enough, and he was too loose through 2004, 2005, when it was obvious that the housing bubble was blowing up. I think now we'll look back at 2013 at a time when the Fed should have been raising interest rates. Europe, the bond yields were coming down by that point. China was doing fine. You know, they had their own bubbles they were inflating. So that was the perfect time to do so. You know, you're 4 years into a recovery. But instead, they decided to juice this equity market bubble. And you know, they would actually have some firepower. If they could get the Fed funds rate back up to 1 or 1.25%, at least they'd have some firepower in the next downturn. And now they're in this, they have this big problem where global growth is slowing. China's in an asset bubble. You know, Japan and Europe, everyone else is loosening. And it's going to be very, very difficult for them to raise rates like they want to.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. David Skirica. His newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can learn more at addictedtoprofits.net. His most recent book is Bear Market Rising. And David, as you were talking and talked about these cycles that are 15 to 20 years, that's totally been confirmed by the research I've done. You can go all the way back to the 1792 with the Mint Act, and we've seen these cycles exist, and we name these cycles after the seasons of the year. And if you look at what Fed policy has done in the market, what's to prevent the Fed from engaging in, another round of QE just to try to keep this equity market propped up?
Oh, because I think there's actually a populist movement against it. Like, for example, the current Labour Party leader in the UK says that he wants to do QE, meaning because QE works so well for asset prices and the people that own assets. He wants to do it so you can build schools and roads and railroads, with the printed money. So I think that even if you see another quantitative quantitative easing, I think what is going to happen is it's not going to be in the form that we saw, last time around, which was to juice the asset market. And, the conspiracy theory would be like they're hanging on Wall Street. But, like I said, I think they just want to create that wealth effect. But I think this time if they do QE is that it will be to, keep the yield of government debt low. And so you can do an infrastructure program or an investment program such as that. Because the problem with QE is, not only enriching, a few, it's none of this money is going into anything real. It's going into financial engineering. It's keeping corporate debt cheap so, companies can turn around and buy their own stock to keep earnings artificially elevated and trigger, and trigger bonuses and this sort of thing. So quantitative easing really, it's actually sucking money out of the economy because it's just going into financial engineering and shenanigans. Where I think that the next form of QE is going to go directly into a program, and I know that, someone who's a libertarian may not agree with this, but the problem is with companies not really doing investment right now, there can be an argument to make that the government has to take a little bit of the slack up, and we all know that the infrastructure in the United States is very subpar. Donald Trump always says this. I don't agree with what he says, but I do agree with him when he says that if you go into a LaGuardia, it's a joke, and if you go into an airport in South Korea or even I live in the Bahamas, a new airport in the Bahamas is pretty immaculate in Nassau. So you need to upgrade the infrastructure of the country, and of course the misuse of capital by the government in these wars, etc. Suck money out of the United States, which so I think that's what the next QE will do. And actually, it'll probably be better for hard assets, U.S. domestic growth. It will help the stock market a bit. But I only see it really helping if it's, coming out of a bear market or something of that like. But I don't think it will be the financially based QE. And like I said, there's this populist uprising against that. That's why you're seeing far-right parties in Europe come to power. That's why you're seeing the popularity of Trump and Sanders is because the current policies of a few people, and the majority of people are not happy with it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll continue our conversation with Mr. David Skirica in the next segment when we will get his outlook for various markets. Stay with us. Everything Financial returns after these words. Before I get back to my conversation with David Skirica, let me remind you that if you would like to listen to any of my interviews that I do with our guest experts at any time, all you need to do is visit the website everythingfinancialradio.com, everythingfinancialradio.com, and all of the interviews are archived there. I'm pleased to be chatting again today with returning guest Mr. David Skirica. David's newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can learn more at addictedtoprofits.net. His most recent book, released just this year, Bear Market Rising. So, David, let's in this segment focus on your forecast for various markets, and let's start with U.S. stock markets. What do you foresee?
Well, obviously, I'm bearish, and interesting technically, we've never seen a market like this with a nearly two-year trading range. There's often been times where there's been a one-year trading range. 1994 was like that. That was obviously before the big breakout, and there's been years where maybe it takes a year to top out. 1961 would have been like that, 93 would have been like that, even 2000 is somewhat like that. So the thing is, but we've never seen a two-year bear market. And actually, this is the longest correction on record. Usually corrections finish by now and hit new highs, or they turn into bear. And I think it's the central banks being proactive, trying to prop up asset prices, which is keeping from this bear market from occurring. But I think at some point, we're going to get some events. It'll be maybe Deutsche Bank or something out of China. Maybe if we can get another Bin Oil, you know, the regional banks in the U.S. having financial problems. Some big events will occur that the central banks cannot bail out the market, and you'll get another kind of liquidation similar to, you know, 2001, 2002, or 2008. At some point, that is going to happen. But the last thing to note on the technicals is it's not just it's not just the foreign markets. You know, the DAX, the FTSE, the Chinese markets have all acted poorly over the last year, the Nikkei. But if you go look at the other markets in the U.S., the Dow Transports are nowhere near their highs. The New York NYSE Composite, which is a more broader measure of stocks than the Dow or S&P, again, nowhere near its highs. And so I think that this rally, even if the S&P were to hit a new high, it's going to be so unconfirmed by these other markets that it's definitely the sign of a major technical top. And by the way, a similar thing happened in 1999 when you had a few stocks driving the NASDAQ and technology indices higher. But if you go look at the Dow Transport or the NYSE or the so-called old economy stocks, they're acting very poorly, and that was a prelude to the bear market.
You know, David, we talked in the last segment a bit about quantitative easing and the massive amount of money that the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, actually created. And yet we didn't see gold react the way that one might have expected gold to react. And now this year, gold is actually seeing a bit of a breakout. There's been some fundamental changes. China now has their own gold exchange. To what extent do you attribute this gold breakout to the Fed money printing, or do you think gold's just rallying because, you know, a lot of other commodities may have bottomed?
Well, I think there was a lot of short covering in the base metals. I'm so bullish on the base metals. You know, stuff like iron ore just has way too much of an oversupply. But when you talked about gold, it relates to what I said earlier, that if the goal of quantitative easing was just to pump asset markets, and it's sucking money out of the real economy. Well, you know, in an ironic way, it's deflationary because it's keeping zombie companies alive. It's, you know, companies are just pouring that money back into stock buybacks and dividends and financial engineering. And if you're sucking money out of the economy, you know, it's helping the asset markets, which then breeds complacency and breeds like this kind of deflationary environment, which also takes people out of gold. So I think that's part of the reason it happened. I think another part of the reason is just part of the cycle. I know we mentioned the cycle. If you look at gold technically back in the 70s, there was a similar decline from 1974 to 1976. This decline was just, about 4.5 years instead of 2.5 years, right? It was a little longer, but the preceding trend was higher too. So I think we're in the kind of lull in the cycle, similar to the mid-70s, and we're getting set up for the next big run. And again, if I'm right, and the next move in policy is infrastructure, well, that means you're going to create demand for concrete and steel and all of these things. And that, again, would be somewhat inflationary and should help gold and precious metals. And you go look at it technically, the HUI, which is the AMAX Gold Bugs Index, to gold ratio got as cheap as it's ever been. I mean, the gold stocks were compared to the metal itself was cheap, even cheaper than the 2000 bottom when gold was 250. So these stocks are incredibly cheap, and now they're coming. And actually, if you want the last technical indicator in gold that makes it really, really simple for the average person to understand where it can go, is that if you go look at the last two tops in gold, and the last two major bottoms in the market in the 30s and in 1980, the Dow Jones to gold ratio went up roughly 1-to-1, 1.5-to-1. So if you're looking at a bear market in stocks and a bull market in gold, so let's say the Dow goes back to 10,000, you know, well, that kind of ratio is about 7 to 10,000. Now, when it's up there, it's going to be a parabolic blow-off, you know, similar to the 79 to 1980 move in gold when it went from $270 to $850 in like a year. So it's not going to, like, it's not like it's 8,000 and sit there for 10 years. You know, you'll probably blow off from 2,000 or 3,000 to that level. But that's the kind of move we're looking at. So I think you got this combination of all these problems in the global economy. The gold is starting to turn higher. The cycle is very similar to the late 70s now in gold and the gold equities. And I think you're really getting set up for a big run. And I think that if you get a recession in the United States, and then, again, this QE starts again, well, that is what holds off. Because one thing that has been, even gold has done well in the last 6 months, one thing that's holding it back is, you know, the U.S. is still talking about raising rates and not joining the QE party with Japan and Europe. And if they do that, well, then every major central bank in the world is printing money, and that is probably going to be very positive for gold.
Yeah, we've got just a couple of minutes left, David. And really, when you look at what's going on around the globe, there is a lot of movement or potential movement as far as currencies are concerned. And there's a lot of talk out there that the U.S. dollar may be in danger of losing the petrodollar status. Of course, if that were to happen, that would be bullish for gold. Do you have an opinion on that topic?
I think, okay, there's two things. I think the number one currency risk out there is the Chinese devaluing the yuan. Their corporate and private, sorry, their private and public debt is 350% of GDP, which is actually higher than the United States. And, you know, they're a developing economy, so they're less likely to be able to, you know, to support that debt without restructuring the banking system with some kind of default or devaluation in the yuan. And that's why I still think there could be one more disruption on kind of the deflationary side, especially in base metal, if that occurs. And the second thing, I think, yeah, there is a move away from the dollar, because the U.S. foreign policy or the whatnot, just too many people are now kind of are fed up. And, you know, you go look at, like, Brazil and China will trade, you know, oil and yuan or reals, and, you know, Russia is going to, you know, take euros or rubles or yuan. So I think there's that move away from the petrodollar, but I still think that's the kind of thing that's going to take another 10 or 15 years to play out. And the problem is, too, is if the Chinese do have to devalue the yuan, that also will be a setback, you know, for the yuan becoming a major player in the short term. But I definitely think, right now, if you look at all these currencies, and, you know, it's not going to be as clear cut because the U.S. is still going to be a power. China's going to be a power. India's emerging power. So I think that more than likely the next move to a reserve currency, rather than just being in the yuan, is going to be a mix of, you know, the U.S. dollar, the rupee, and maybe even the real. You know, and remember, British pound still makes up a very small percent of global reserves. So I think it'll be more like a mix. But I definitely think there's a move away from that, but that's the type of thing that's going to take a long time. Because if you remember, the British really started to come into financial trouble at the end of World War One, and it wasn't until after World War Two, which is over 30 years later, that the pound really lost its reserve status. So who knows how long this could take.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. David Skorica. His newsletter is Addicted to Profits. You can learn more at addictedtoprofits.net. And David, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time I have for this week's Everything Financial Radio podcast. Hope you got something you can use. I'll be back again next week with Mr. Jim Babka from DownsizedDC.org.